Love your neighbor as yourself. Right? The fundamental Jewish ethical teaching. I think there's probably not a person in the universe who speaks English who couldn't finish a sentence, love your neighbor as blank, yourself. It's so well known. It's shaped the world. And, you know, sometimes I study with people who describe themselves as non-religious or not connected to the heritage, and sometimes they're not connected. And I'll ask them a question, and they'll answer in such a Jewish way, reflecting Jewish values, and they don't realize how profoundly they've been impacted by Jewish values. Right? This commandment to love your neighbor as yourself, which seems very natural to us Jews today, and to a good part of the world today, was a revolution. You know, think about how this would go over in the ancient world. For example, hi, David. If you say to the ancient Greeks, love your neighbor as yourself, they would say, what? That sounds bizarre. The gods don't do that. In the Greek gods were always fighting with each other. They were jealous. They weren't connected to each other. The notion of love your neighbor as yourself would be very bizarre to the ancient Greeks. They tried to emulate their gods who were jealous of each other and always fighting with each other. You say to a Roman, love your neighbor as yourself, that would be bizarre to them. Because what do the Romans do for entertainment? They went to the Colosseum. What they do there, they watched their neighbor being thrown to the lions. That's what they went to for entertainment. So the notion to them of love your neighbor as yourself was a bizarre notion. The Jewish people revolutionized the world with its Torah with this commandment that seems so intuitive to us, to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I mentioned that any person who speaks English could finish that sentence, love your neighbor as yourself. But the truth is, the sentence is not finished yet. Does anyone know? Love your neighbor as yourself is not the end of the sentence. It goes on, I am God. Love your neighbor as yourself, I am God. Which is interesting because the Torah, almost every page of the Torah says that God spoke to Moses, to Moshe, and said, tell the Jewish people, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. Every time there's a commandment, it doesn't say, I am God. It doesn't say, honor your parents, I am God. It doesn't say, keep Shabbat, I am God. It doesn't say, don't be jealous, I am God. Yet when it comes to love your neighbor as yourself, the Torah continues by saying, I am God. Somehow, I am God here is central to this commandment, right? Also, many people who can recite the sentence overlook, and this is very typical, most people, I think, would overlook it, there's a revolution in this verse. Besides the fact, you've asked most people, what is this verse saying? To love your neighbor, right? But it says something else. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. That tells us something. This verse is not only declaring that you should love your neighbor, but it's saying love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, it's assuming that we also will be loving ourselves. It's not so obvious, it's not so simple, and the truth of the matter is that this commandment was thousands of years before its time, and it's before its time even today, because today we know that self-esteem is a $1 billion industry. It's not so natural. In fact, many people, if not most people, perhaps don't love themselves. They don't feel good about themselves. They look for all kinds of ways to make themselves feel good. But at the core, they don't necessarily feel good about themselves. The Torah is saying, love your neighbor as yourself. It's saying that, number one, you should love yourself. And that should be extended to love your neighbor as well. I am God. Right, so the question is, how do we do this? How do we begin this process of loving ourselves, loving others? Right, and the Torah is really telling us that somehow God is relevant to this. You know, I'm pretty sure that everyone here who's from Chicago, maybe even some who are not from Chicago but have visited Chicago, everyone here in Chicago has visited the Adler Planetarium. I'm sure that's absolutely true. But anyone who lives in Chicago has been there. It's a fascinating place, right? So Adler Planetarium was endowed by a Jewish fellow named Max Adler. Now, you would assume that the person who endowed the planetarium must have been a big science buff. He must have really been into science. He wanted to share science with everybody, introduce people to the beauties of science. So a number of years ago, his son wrote an article about him, and he said, my father had no interest in science whatsoever. So you wonder, if that's the case, why would he endow the planetarium? There's many things you could do with your money. Like CTN could use a few $1 million. Now, why would he endow the planetarium if he didn't have an affinity for science? So it's very, very interesting. His son said that his father had an agenda, a very good agenda. What was the agenda? He was bothered by the fact that there's so much strife in the world, people beating each other up, disrespecting each other. Sounds a little familiar, right? Nothing, not much has changed. He was bothered by that, and he wanted to do something to get people to stop beating each other up and to respect each other. I'm assuming that the connection is not very obvious to anybody. What's the connection? So the connection is his thought process was like this. He said to himself, if I can get, let's say, Moshe Katz to go to the planetarium, right? And Moshe Katz will look up at the skies and he'll see the stars and the galaxies and the planets and the huge, perhaps infinite universe. And he'll say to himself, you know, Moshe Katz, you're not such a knocker. Who do you think you are? You're a little speck on a speck in the universe, right? Because the Earth is a speck in the universe. So Moshe Katz is, and if he goes to the planetarium, he'll be reminded that he's just a speck on the speck in the universe. So he figured, if that's the case, if people will realize how small they are, they'll stop beating each other up. Right? Did it work? Obviously not, right? Because most people have been there, but it hasn't solved the problem. But there's a basic flaw in his logic here. We're very well-intentioned, right? He wants to get people to stop beating each other up, to respect each other. So his plan is make people realize how small they are. Right? So anyone sense the problem, right? People who beat each other up, are they usually people with healthy self-esteem or weak self-esteem? Weak, right? Usually people with healthy self-esteem don't need to beat each other up to make themselves feel good, right? So people with low self-esteem that are likely to beat each other up. So reinforcing that, you really are a little speck on a speck in the universe. It's not only not preventing it, it's feeding the problem. Right? What does the Torah say? The Torah says, no. Look, the Torah says Moshe Katz should look up at the galaxies and say to himself, wow, God created all these galaxies and all these planets, all these solar systems. And then he said, okay, neat trick. Now let's get down to business. Let's create human beings. And we're the purpose of creation, right? Then you take Moshe Katz and everyone else and you lift them up and you make them feel important. Now, I once mentioned this idea in a class, and I said, the problem is that if you convince me that I'm a speck, if I'm a speck, you're also a speck, right? And one guy yelled out, you're a smaller speck than I am. And a speck could look at someone else and say they're a smaller speck. But if I'm a speck, you're a speck, right? The Torah wants us to look at the galaxies and say, wow, I'm not a speck, I'm important. And if I'm important, then you're important. That's the way the Torah wants us to relate to each other, right? So when the Torah says, love your neighbor as yourself, the starting point is that we should be loving ourselves. Now, why should we love ourselves? Why should we feel good about ourselves? The reason there's a billion-dollar industry of self-esteem is because when people are taught or see themselves as being here by accident, there's no purpose to our being here. So they don't know, why am I here? Why am I important? What am I supposed to do now that I'm here? Why do I matter? Right? So the first step is we should love ourselves. We should feel important. Why? Because I am God. Each and every one of us are here because God put us here. God created us. Right? That means that God wants us to be here. And God has faith in us, like we've mentioned in the past. He has faith in us that we can somehow contribute to this world to make the world a better place. All right, so self-esteem has a beginning, and loving of ourselves has a beginning because I love myself because God put me here. I'm a creature of God. God put something of the godly within us, which is what we call the neshama, the soul. Now, typically, if you preach to people, love yourself, very often people who love themselves, or you might say they're full of themselves, people who love themselves very often are not considerate to others, right? Because if you love yourself, you focus on yourself and your needs and what you want, what's important to you, and you neglect the concern for others, right? So what does the Torah say? That, you know, if you know me at all, you know that I'm actually a big fan of the Torah. You know, it's just amazing to me. Sometimes I think that this verse is if we could say, one of the most amazing verses. It's just a few words that expresses so much. Love yourself, because I am God, right? And you're here because God put you here, and God wants you to be here, and you're important to God. Therefore, you should love yourself, right? Now, what about the danger that if I love myself, I'm going to be less concerned about others? No. I am God. Love yourself because I am God. And if you love yourself because you're here because God put you here, how do you relate to other people? For the same reason I should love myself, I need to love other people. The whole basis for the love of ourselves is the fact that God put us here. So that's the same compelling reason to love other people. So the Torah puts it so briefly. Love your neighbor like yourself. Love yourself, then extend it to your neighbor, because I am God. The root of the love for yourself is because I am God who put you here. And for the same reason, you need to love other people. So in just one little sense, the Torah gives us the basis for loving ourselves and guards against the danger of loving ourselves, because the same reason that we love ourselves compels us to love and respect other people. Okay? So it begins by loving ourselves, by knowing who we are, right? And you know, at the same time, the Torah tells us that God says, I'm putting you here because you can make the world a better place. And if you slip up, which we all will slip up, don't worry, pick yourself up and work harder and become better, right? So we can feel good about ourselves, right? You know, the privilege of being here brings responsibilities, but the foundation is there for feeling good about ourselves, for having healthy self-esteem. You know, the Torah says that many people may have heard that the Talmud says that God chose Mount Sinai to give the Torah on. Why? Because it's a little mountain. He didn't give it on Mount Everest. Put on a humble mountain, because humility is important. Right? So the question is asked by many commentaries, if humility is important, then that's why he chose a small mountain. So forget a mountain, give the Torah in a valley. The answer is that a healthy self-esteem is important. We're not supposed to be valleys. We're supposed to be a mountain, just not Mount Everest. We should feel that we're important, but not become haughty and think that we're Mount Everest. You know, some of you may remember, some of you maybe were actually involved in it, but some of you maybe wish that some people in your life were not involved in it. I mean football. And around 6 years ago, there was a big to-do called Deflate Gate. Anyone remember Deflate Gate? It's kind of thing that when it happens, you think it will be remembered forever, and now most people probably don't even remember. But Deflate Gate, as in deflated, was about around 6 years ago, I think it was, the Patriots football, the official football, was not kosher. It was found to be deflated. It wasn't inflated to the extent that it's supposed to be. It was a big, big tumult, because is the game valid, not valid, because there's very, very strict regulations of how the football has to be made and how much it should be inflated. Then there was a lot of discussion, does it make a difference if it's in the game if it's inflated a little bit less? Does it matter? So I saw a discussion about that, and a science teacher wrote an article, and he said, you know, to me as a teacher, I see this as a hook. Teacher always looks for a hook. How can I hook people to focus them on their mind on something? He said, I see, this is a hook. You have this issue of a deflated ball. Does it make a difference or not? That's a hook to engage people. So I said to myself, if a scientist could do that, and a rabbi could do it also. Right? So I think when we think about deflated football, right, and that's not kosher, we should realize that a deflated person is also not kosher. Right, healthy self-esteem, the Torah demands of us to have healthy self-esteem, to have self-love, just to make sure that we don't become haughty and that we extend the same love towards others. So again, the Torah is telling us, look at the world through the world, I am God world, and when you do that, then it's natural to have self-love, and we could talk about loving other people because the same reason applies to both. Right? I want to tell you a story about a great woman who was great in her own right, and she was married to a great man. Right? She was what we call a Rebbetzin, a rabbi's wife, and she was married to one of the great rabbis of our generation. His name was Rabbi Ayo Leib Steinman. He lived in Israel, and he was one of the great rabbis of the generation, which means he had total recall of the entire Talmud, the whole body of Torah. And as I always say, when we say great rabbi in Jewish tradition, we mean great not only in knowledge, but also a great heart. And his life was devoted to helping others. Every waking day, a minute of his life was spent either studying, praying, eating very little, sleeping very little, and the rest of his time was helping people, meeting people and people bearing their hearts to him and their problems and asking advice, etc. He's an incredible, incredible person. He lived to be 104 years old. Right? And, you know, sometimes we get it, we reach a certain point where we start thinking that I'm not so young anymore. He was young till his last day of 104 years old. Right? And he had a sense of humor till his last day. In fact, it's a delicious story, I think. When I think he was 103 or so at the time, and his doctor told him that he can't fast on Yom Kippur. Because, you know, he was weak. I mean, for the last few years of his life, every once in a while it looked like he started to deteriorate. It looks like it's all over, and he somehow would bounce back. So at one point, his doctor, who was a very religious person, told him that, Rabbi, I'm telling you that you're not allowed to fast. You know, in Jewish tradition, if fasting could endanger someone's life, they're not only permitted to eat, they're obligated to eat. So the rabbi told him that this year you're obligated to eat, Rabbi, because it would be too dangerous for you to fast. And the rabbi said that, no, you can't tell me that. What do you mean? I'm your doctor. He said, how much experience do you have with 103-year-old patients? He said, you have no experience with people my age, so you don't know. I mean, of course, he knew that doctor knew, but that was his way of kibitzing, even when he was 103 years old. So, and people would come from America, talk about their problems, and you would think, you're in America, you come to me for your problems, but no, he constantly spent time helping people in every area of their life. So obviously, his wife had to be either a very special person or a miserable person, because he married to a person who devotes his whole life to the Jewish people. Right? And it's traditional that before Yom Kippur, we're supposed to ask people for forgiveness. So if you approach each other, in case I slighted you in any way, please forgive me. So people would come to the rabbi and say, please forgive me if I did anything wrong. So the rabbi says, big deal. You come to me, big deal. First of all, you never hurt me. Second of all, you know that if I hurt you, I'll forgive you. So that's easy. Go to somebody who you really think you might have hurt, you know, where it's hard to go and say, I think I may have hurt you. Please forgive me. You know, he would tell people, you know, with a smile, he would tell people that, you know, if you want to really become self-proved before Yom Kippur, don't come to ask me forgiveness. Ask the people that you really, really may have hurt. Anyways, so his wife was obviously a very special person. And I'm telling you this story because I think this story illustrates this concept. You know, for all of us, this idea of love your neighbor like yourself is a work in progress. You know, we can aspire to it, but it's a tremendous level to reach. So, and occasionally there are great people who actually reached that level. So when he died, when the rabbi died, so somebody was eulogizing the rabbi. And then he said, I want to tell you something about the rabbi's wife. Because I said, obviously, she had to be a very special person. She totally supported him in all of his endeavors. He hardly ate anything, hardly slept. So the story that the rabbi told was that, and they had no connection to materialism. You know, their apartment was was beer, like, you know, just the beer necessities. Although if someone would have sent out an email just to the Jewish world, we'll put together a fund to build a mansion for Rabbi Steinman. In 10 minutes, they would have had $1 million. Yeah, but they had no interest. So the story was that she met somebody. She was schmoozing with somebody. And she mentioned to the other woman that's a very nice necklace that you're wearing. Okay. So the woman said, oh, thank you very much, Rebbitzin. You know, truth of the matter is, I would be honored to buy a necklace like this for you. You deserve to wear a necklace like this. I'd be honored to buy you one. So a person who's not materialistic might say, no, I'm fine with that. It's nice that you have it. I'm fine. But her response was amazing, I think. Her response was? She said, it is a beautiful necklace. And it's a pleasure to look at it, to see it. But what's the difference if I'm wearing it, if you're wearing it? There's no me, you, I wish I had one. It's a beautiful necklace. I see someone wearing it. I feel it's a pleasure. What's the difference if it's me or if it's you? In other words, when you really, really connect to love your neighbor as yourself, then we're one. So, you know, your right hand is not jealous of your left hand. In a healthy marriage, one spouse is not jealous of the other. Right. So and people who have really perfected the art of loving their neighbor like themselves, there's no jealousy. It doesn't matter. It's my right hand has a gold watch. I should get one for my left hand too. There's no need for it. As long as you have the watch on your hand, what's the difference? So really, we're all one, right? So in her perspective, in her level, it makes no difference if I'm wearing the necklace or you're wearing it. It's a beautiful necklace. It's nice to see somebody wearing it, you know? So one of the reasons I chose this particular tool, because I think it's very relevant to Rosh Hashanah. You know, we've discussed in the past that when we talk about being judged by God, right? Part of that judgment is how we relate to God and how we relate to His children. And the more connected we are to His children, the more we feel that we're one with His children, right? The more pleased God is with us and the better chance we have, right, of having favorable judgment. So Rosh Hashanah, work up to Rosh Hashanah is about working on our relationship with God as well as our relationship with other people. And the more we can love each other as we love ourselves, right, the better our case is on Rosh Hashanah. You know, it's always good. The more you connect it to other people, the better our case, so to speak, is on Rosh Hashanah. You know, someone once gave a cute metaphor. You know, if you go shopping, you pick out fruit. So let's say you're picking out peaches. So you examine each one. You want each one to be a nice, beautiful peach. And if it looks a little bruised, you put it back. And if it's not nearly close to being ripe, you put it back. Right? If you buy a 5-pound bag of peaches, then by definition, you know, you're not examining each one, and you're paying a certain price, and you'll buy 5 pounds. You're not as fussy about examining each peach. Right? So you see where we're headed here. When we're by ourselves, and we're judged, right? Then we might be judged very, very carefully. Right? If we're, so to speak, part of a whole group, right? Then, so to speak, God might be less fussy about us. You know, that's one of the reasons that we pray with the congregation, because it's much better approaching God as a group, right? And even in the congregation, the more we really connected to the other people, again, the stronger our case is. So the take home here is that, once again, as the Torah says, love your neighbor as yourself. Step number one is you need to love yourself. And you have to work on that. You know, sometimes it even helps. You know, I meet people sometimes and I tell them you're being too strong on yourself, because sometimes when you want to become better, you can be too tough on yourself. So we have to realize at the core that we're important because God created us, God put us here. Right? And for the same reason, we need to love others because God put them there. Right. And we should learn from this great woman, Rebbitzin Steinman, right? That we're all this together. Because again, when we say, when we see the root of this, that we have because of God, I mean, God put us all here because he wants something from us as a group. He wants the world to be a certain type of world, right? Especially the Jewish people, we're one group, right? And when we get in touch with that, that goes so far to remove jealousy, to just to make us be happy about every good thing that we see. Because it doesn't matter if we try to be as good as we can. If someone else got this mitzvah and did something beautiful, then we should be happy as well. Right? So it's a tall order, right? Like somebody once saw a bumper sticker that said, there's a reason that God gave the Ten Commandments, not the Ten Suggestions. Right, so it's a tall order and it's a work in process, but we should all strive to love ourselves better. Again, keeping in mind I am God, so that we can become haughty and extend that love to others, right? And learn from Rebbe Steinmetz that we should simply take joy in every success of other people as much as we do ourselves, because we are basically all one.